This is a story of the corruption of science.
There's no such thing as a climate emergency happening on this planet now. There's no evidence of one.
The climate alarm is nonsense, you know, it's a hoax. I've never liked hoax. I think scam is a better word, but I'm willing to live with hoax.
It's a story about the bullying and intimidation of anyone who dares to challenge the climate alarm.
To speak up against or about climate change in any sort of skeptical way was essentially career suicide.
Activists are even calling for any skepticism to be criminalized.
It's the story of an assault on individual freedom.
It's a wonderful way to increase government power. If there's an existential threat out there that's worldwide, well, you need a powerful worldwide government, you know, to cope with it.
We see all these kind of authoritarian measures being adopted in the name of saving the planet.
You've suddenly got the population under control all over the world.
That's from Climate, the movie, The Cold Truth, published by Daily Signal. But our discussion today is about a book with the same theme, just different approach. It's called Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. This is part two of the discussion that we started with Dr. Cal Beisner and Dr. David LeGates just a few days ago. But this time we're going to be talking about the whole corruption of the scientific industry. We're going to be talking about the war against fossil fuels. And we're also going to discuss the religious implications of this. Well, one of the things that we know about the environmental movement, it really is very much anti-human. Humans don't matter. In fact, humans are the ones causing this destruction of the earth, according to their narrative. And so it's just, it's the opposite worldview, really, of followers of Christ. It really is the opposite, because God has told us that human life is precious. And so that's why we talk about abortion. That's why environmentalists, I don't think, are too keen. They're not so involved in saving babies' lives, at least not the hardcore ones. And that's because of their view of the world. And our view of the world says that babies matter, an innocent life matters, an unborn innocent life matters. You know, President Biden has vowed to restore Roe versus Wade as the law of the land. And we remember that there were 65 babies who have already been sacrificed in the name of abortion. I'm not sure how much longer God is going to take this. How much longer he's going to stand by before he brings judgment to us, really. And that's, you know, we want to save babies not to prevent judgment on us, although that would be nice. We want to do that because it's right, and we know it's the heart of God. $28 buys one ultrasound, or provides one ultrasound, for a mom who's found herself pregnant, and it's a bad time. She's embarrassed, whatever the problem is. Economically, it's difficult. She's starting school. I don't know. Fill in the blanks. And $28 provides an ultrasound where that woman, that mom-to-be, can see her baby in the womb and see its characteristics, hear its heartbeat. It's amazing. And when that happens, most of them decide to keep their babies, or at least to let them live. Even if they adopt them out, that's a great option. And so if you'd like to help Preborn provide those ultrasounds, it's $28 for one of them. Go to preborn.com/Sandy. That's preborn.com/Sandy and make your best donation. And by the way, thank you for those great messages that you've been leaving. It's 662-821-2040 if you would like to leave us a message that we can respond to. You can write us at sandy@afr.net, sandy@afr.net. You can listen to the podcast on any platform that you're accustomed to. AFR.net is our home base. That's American Family Radio, and that's where I got my roots, and that's who I still work with. And so that's where you can find the show. You can also find it at my website, sandyrios.com. That's an easy way to listen as well. Try to make it easy so that you can listen and so that you can tell others about the show. Well, I'm so glad you're listening, because today is part two of our discussion with Cal Beisner and Dr. David LeGates. And the discussion, of course, is on their new book, Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, on today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness.
that we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice, not social justice, but God's justice, what's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association,
a pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
There's a huge amount of money involved, and this is a huge, big money scam.
There are not just now billions, but there are trillions of dollars at stake.
It's a story of self-interest and big government funding.
People like me, our careers depend on funding of climate research. This is what I've been doing just about my whole career. This is what the other climate researchers are doing with their whole career. They don't want this to end.
If CO2 isn't having the huge negative impacts that we claimed it was having originally, how are we going to stay in business?
A lot of people's livelihoods depend on it. They're not going to give that up.
All right, we're talking to Dr. Cal Beiser, founder and president of the Cornwall Alliance, and Dr. David Legates, who is a professor emeritus at the University of Delaware, a professor of climatology. And so you heard that clip, Cal, and I just you follow the economics of this. So is that true? Is their claim true? Is this about money to, you know, create a industry for scientists?
Okay. Absolutely. Yeah, we're talking governments spending trillions of dollars subsidizing wind and solar energy to try to replace coal and natural gas as our most biggest electricity sources. We're talking the likely cost of trying to achieve what is called net zero, that is, our carbon dioxide emissions being matched by how much carbon dioxide is taken out of the air. The likely cost of achieving net zero is going to be going to raise to over $26 trillion per year by the end of this century. The result of that is to greatly slow economic development. And, you know, even the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in its 2018 special report on global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius, told us that even if we did nothing to try to slow global warming, the resulting warming would only reduce global total wealth production per year by about 2.6%. Now, at first we think, oh, well, that's a big problem. But it's not, because it's 2.6% of total global wealth production at the end of this century that is just slightly under nine times what it is today. So in other words, what they're telling us is that this global warming that is supposedly an existential threat is going to make us only about 8.5 times richer at the end of the century instead of almost 9 times richer at the end of the century. Well, if you know anything about human mortality rates and illness and so on, you know that poverty is a far greater threat to human health and well-being than anything related to weather. If you have income equivalent to, say, the bottom 5% of Americans, you can thrive in any climate from the Arctic Circle to the Sahara Desert to the Brazilian rainforest. If you're trying to get by on the equivalent of about $2 a day, you can't thrive in the best tropical paradise. And so what we need to recognize is that this effort to fight global warming is putting money into things that will actually not help human beings significantly, but taking it away from the things that do help us significantly. So the cost-benefit analysis comes down really solidly. Even if the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is right in what it says about how much warming we get from added CO2 in the atmosphere, even according to that very same body, humanity will be much better off at the end of this century than it is today. We discuss that in our book, Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. And by the way, this being April 1st, here's no fooling, right? The Cornwall Alliance is offering this book, and during the month of April, as our way of saying thank you when people make a donation of literally any size and ask for it, we'll send them a free copy of Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, an almost 500-page hardback book that I think they will find fascinating, and they'll be glad that they'll have had an opportunity to help to spread the news that, frankly, we don't need to waste trillions of dollars fighting global warming. Instead, we need to continue working to see entire societies in the developing world lifted out of poverty and into prosperity.
So, Cal, you know, you surprised me. So should they go to your website, cornwallalliance.org, to ask for that? Okay, cornwallalliance.org.
Right, cornwallalliance.org/donate, and then as they fill out a donation form, if they just simply will put somewhere in there, please send me Climate and Energy. We'll know what they're asking for, and we'll be glad to send it. And the donation will remain 100% tax deductible.
Okay, great. cornwallalliance.org/donate. Okay, David, speaking of money, I think those guys in that clip were talking about the incredible amounts of money poured into research. In fact, okay, explain to us better than I can how researchers are following the money, not science. And I think that's what's happening here, correct?
Yep. This goes back actually to 1988. I was a new faculty member at the University of Oklahoma. The university had its 100th anniversary, and they brought in all sorts of important people to talk about various aspects of where they thought their specialties were going in the next 20 to 40 years. And we brought in, the School of Meteorology brought in Bob Correll from the federal government, and he lamented the fact that all the money that seemed to go to research went to either the solid earth geophysicists to drill holes in the ground or to the interplanetary astrophysicists to build spaceships and satellites, and essentially then said, you know, we have been, the atmospheric science community has been the weak stepchild. But that's about to change because we're on the verge of climate change money coming into the system. And I'm expecting then him to go into detail on how this is going to change our ability to forecast tornadoes, severe weather, weather forecasting, all these kinds of things I'm expecting him to cover. And instead, he had one take-home message. Don't kill the goose that's laying the golden egg. And I didn't quite understand at the time, but now I do. Universities run on the overhead of research grants. When I say overhead, what happens is, you know, if I get a research grant at a university, then I'm using university equipment, I'm using lights, a building, so forth. How does the university recoup those costs? What they did early on was to sit down and say, all right, based upon where you're submitting, you'll pay a certain percentage of the grant to the university to cover all this stuff. And places like Harvard, it's 102%. So if you get $200,000 grant, more than $100,000 of it goes straight to the government, or excuse me, straight to Harvard to be able to run various things, has nothing to do with a grant. Most universities are about 50%. So about a third goes to the university and about two-thirds goes to the actual science that has been proposed. Universities, therefore, make lots of money on these grants. And climate change has since become a large enterprise where there's lots of things, both on the social aspects, on the scientific aspects, on the economic aspects. There's lots of things you can apply for. The universities bring in lots of money. Those are the kind of researchers they like. They don't like researchers like me who say, wait a second, the emperor has no clothes. This research is all bunk. It's not going anywhere. It's, you know, and let's get back to real research because they're afraid they're going to lose their funding. And that's the key to all this, is that the money that has been brought into climate change has now been sucked up by the universities, and they can't live without it.
Yes, and if you don't embrace it, you can't do proper research. And it's, of course, that's the way it is in so many disciplines. As you know, we won't get off track, but that's why we can't trust science. You know, science was kind of the god of this country since I think the 60s. Science, you know, trust science. I think some people still certainly embrace that. They did on COVID. They do on all kinds of things. And they are being misled because the money is going. Scientists are following the money, not the true research. Cal, let's turn our attention to something that's really affecting people right now, mm-hmm. really, I think, deeply. And that's the whole business of fossil fuels and cars. The Environmental Protection Agency has issued final regulations requiring 70% of new cars sold to be hybrid or battery powered electric by 2032. And I think Joe Biden had weighed in on this as well recently. First of all, they're trying to stop us from affecting climate change through driving these cars fueled by fossil fuels. I think that's the point. But the economic impact of that, both of those things, can you address them, please?
Yeah, well, first off, we're going to see how that regulation upholds in the courts. There are lawsuits against it, and that is yet to be seen. I don't think it's going to last terribly long, which is a bit of good news. The idea is to try to prevent us from using gasoline or diesel-powered automobiles, and to do that by just simply making the regulation for average fleet CO2 emissions from any automaker so low that you can't reach that level without going to primarily electric vehicles. Problems. First off, the electric vehicles cost much more per vehicle than the comparable internal combustion engine vehicles. And it's not just how much you pay on the showroom floor. It's also all the costs put into that by the subsidies along the way, the subsidies and the tax credits along the way that are being borne by other taxpayers every time somebody buys an electric vehicle. The ultimate deal is that the average electric, average EV runs about $50,000 more than the average internal combustion engine vehicle similar to it. The individual buyer doesn't pay all of that difference, pays a significant part of it, but other taxpayers do, which means that we have less left in our pockets to spend on other things like food and clothing and shelter and schooling and so on. All right, so that's a part of the problem. Another part of the problem is that, frankly, using these EVs does not significantly reduce overall emissions of the so-called demon gas of carbon dioxide. Why not? Because you have to account for all of the mining that goes into making their EVs. You have to account for all of the refining of the mined materials, everything else like that. Once you've done that, you have put EVs almost on a par with ICEs as far as their greenhouse gas emissions. And then, of course, you have some other problems, too. The EVs weigh much, much more than internal combustion engines, and therefore they cause greater breakdown of our roads. Well, it takes fossil fuels to make the asphalt that paves our highways, and those break down faster. So, you know, all kinds of problems here with the demand for EVs, and we've hardly even looked at their reliability. What happens in extreme cold? Well, they lose their power, and they don't charge as quickly. Additionally, we're going to have to use a huge amount more electricity that's got to be transmitted all over the country to charging stations. That requires vast expansion of our transmission system, and it means that we have to generate so much more electricity. All of that generation, if it's not wind and solar or nuclear, is going to require more emissions of greenhouse gases. So the whole thing is, frankly, I think, self-defeating, but it's part of what David was talking about, the financial aspect of this. You've got enormous industries, businesses, making EVs, making wind turbines, making solar panels and the like. And, of course, they have vast amounts, you know, trillions of dollars worth of revenues resting on this. And you better believe they are lobbying Congress and lobbying the federal regulatory agencies like crazy in order to pad their own nests.
You know, it's interesting. A lot of things are interesting. But it's amazing to me how the auto manufacturers have not resisted this, and they've lost a lot of money, you know, manufacturing electric cars because Americans are not convinced. I just read, and also just as a byproduct, I should get into this on a different subject, but lithium batteries, the lithium of the world has been snatched by China, you know, mining it in various countries around the world. And they just had, they have suffered an 80% loss in the lithium market, which I think is interesting. But one other stat I wanted to mention to you, I just read that this morning, Germany is far ahead of us in renewable energy and their mandates, and they have driven consumer prices to more than triple the levels seen in the United States. Think about that. I mean, this is just, it's crippling the economy. There's a sinister thing going on here, Cal. Can you, in a word, in a sentence or a paragraph, explain what sinister thing is happening? This is not just about, you know, energy or clean air. It's just not.
Yeah, well, partly it does go back to what David was talking about a while ago, that the people who want big government controlling all of our lives want us dependent on government, and they want us not financially able to travel around and see things for ourselves, because the more you travel around, the more you get to know. And a well-informed citizenry is not the friend of a totalitarian government. America was founded in many respects on the basic principle that government is supposed to be by consent of the governed. Well, if you can control the way people think, then consent of the governed really doesn't mean anything significant anymore. That's, I think, a very important part of why the powers that be here, the ones who are backing this climate catastrophist narrative, which is really not well supported by real science, they see this as a path toward global government, toward the breakdown of national sovereignty. It's of a par with the open borders movement and all of these different things, designed to move decision-making for governments farther and farther away from the individual citizen to higher and higher levels where there's less and less accountability.
You know, this reminds me of a PBS documentary that I saw not long ago, well, a couple of years ago, called Horatio's Drive. And it's about a gentleman who made a bet in San Francisco, made in the late 1800s, that he could drive a car across the United States. There weren't roads across the United States at that time. And he drove from San Francisco to New York City. And the documentary has actual video, I'm not sure about that, but photos of him driving and all the obstacles. But the point they make in the documentary is how the car became the catalyst to Americans actually being able to get out of their atmosphere, their way they were raised. Most of them had never gone more than 5 miles or eight maybe from their homes. And this was allowing people to get out. It allowed them freedom. It changed the whole culture of the United States, that gave people freedom. And this is exactly what they want to take from us. Are we talking with Cal Beisner and David LeGates? And the book is called Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. Just, we've covered so many great topics, and there's one more thing I want to talk to them about. And that is, Cal and David, when I was on radio in Chicago in the 90s, I used to interview an environmental reporter for one of the major magazines, very highly read. This was his expertise. I didn't just have Christians on my show then, I don't now. But we had these great conversations. And one time off the air, he said to me that he had actually, he said, I don't want you to say this publicly, but I have become a Christian. He said, I've been in the belly of this environmental movement, and I've seen the wickedness of it. It's just evil. I never, ever was awake to evil until this. And it had driven him to seek, you know, some sort of faith, and he had. And still to this day, I don't know if he talks about that publicly, so I don't mention his name. But I just wondered, Cal, what your thoughts are about that. You've been working in this for a long time, and you are a believer. But what have you seen? Some people say this is a religion. Do you agree?
I certainly think that there are religious aspects to it, but all sorts of different parts of the environmental movement. And some people in it are in it for thoroughly, thoroughly religious reasons, some much more for secular reasons, some are in it for political power reasons, some for financial reasons, some because they sincerely believe that we're destroying the planet and we need to rescue the planet and so on. So we can't just kind of paint with a super broad brush, but of course I don't know the person you're talking about, but I actually have a friend who was an environmental scientist, and who, as he watched what was being said about acid rain and the lies that were being told about that, and he did tremendous research under the federal government about acid rain, and he discovered that, well, it wasn't actually primarily a problem coming from coal-burning power plants, and it wasn't killing forests, that there were natural explanations that were much more powerful on that front. And then what he watched was how the movement, using acid rain fears as a basis for turning people away from abundant, affordable, reliable energy from coal, simply ignored the truth of empirical scientific findings and pushed the lie. That is what led him to ask himself, why are these people lying so much? And he began reading books, actually, of Christian apologetics by C.S. Lewis and Norman Geisler and the like. This was back in the late 70s, early 1980s, and he became a Christian. And he realized that there was that very, Jesus says that Satan is the father of lies, right? There is a satanic origin for much of what I see as the lying that is very prevalent in a lot of the environmental movement. That's not to say that everybody involved knows that what they're claiming as truth is actually false. I think most of the people are being honest, but there are people in the background who are not being honest, and they're providing the basic narrative, and then other people, in all good motive, latch on to that and pass it around. So, yeah, there is that aspect, and there's another, too. The environmental movement turns things upside down as far as the way God designed his creation and the human role in creation. In Genesis 1 and 2 and 3, we read, and this is affirmed all through the scriptures, that we should see a hierarchy. God at the top, man made in his image to rule over the creation as his representative in a way that enhances its fruitfulness, its beauty, and its safety to the glory of God and the benefit of our neighbors, and then the rest of the creation under man. The environmental movement turns that upside down. It puts the creation at the top, man under that, and if there's any room for God at all, he's kind of an afterthought after humanity. This is exactly what the Apostle Paul tells us in Romans chapter 1 leads to great perversion of thought, great confusion. He says, when we begin to worship and serve the creature rather than the creator, God gives us over to reprobate minds. Thinking ourselves wise, we become fools. And from that come all kinds of evil. So I think there is clearly a religious element to this. Let me give you one example, too, that is particularly related to the fears of catastrophic global warming driven by human emissions of greenhouse gases. The Bible tells us in Genesis 1 that when God had finished creating everything, he looked at it all, and behold, it was very good, right? Now, the climate system is part of what he had created. So he declared the climate system, among everything, other things, very good. Now, does it make sense to think that if we increase carbon dioxide from 28,000ths of 1% of the atmosphere to 56,000ths of 1% of the atmosphere, the result is going to be devastating change of global climate that just wipes out humanity, maybe even wipes out all of life. We're talking about a great species extinction problem because of climate change. There's no empirical evidence that it's actually happening, but that's the prediction people are making. Does that make sense? I don't think so. An infinitely wise God designed, an infinitely powerful God created, an infinitely faithful God sustains his creation. He says it's good. He says in Genesis 8:22, that as long as heaven and earth endure, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will not cease. I don't think it makes sense to think that that minute change in atmospheric chemistry is going to cause disaster. It's not consistent with a biblical worldview. It's not consistent with our understanding of God and his relationship to his creation. It's not consistent with the Bible's understanding of the quality of the creation that God made. And what I think is so fascinating is that when we get down to the hard empirical facts, instead of just computer climate modeling, which are not facts, that's hypothesis. When we get down to the hard empirical facts, what we find is that the slight changes in atmospheric chemistry, sure, they'll try to drive some change in temperature, but certainly not anything devastating.
You know, I know you guys probably know who Barry Weiss is. Barry was a writer for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal. Yeah. And she's been moderating her views. I don't think she's made any declarations, but she's certainly moving in a different direction. And she has she did an interview with Paul Kingsnorth, who you guys may very well know who he is. He was one of the most radical and prominent environmentalists, in the world. He chained himself to a bridge in protest of road construction, and he was led the Ecologist, which described by Barry as a left-wing environmental magazine. But he became disillusioned, and he's become a Christian, and it's a whole story that she's written, which is fascinating. And I just see a pattern here. It's just fascinating. You know, all truth is God's truth, and certainly we have a God of truth, and that means science. And science is not mutually exclusive, to God's word, because they're both, when rightly explained and interpreted, as they are both about truth. Dr. David Legates, what final thing? What have we missed? What's the final thing you'd like to say about your book, Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism, or the content there? Is there something we've missed?
I don't know if there's anything we've missed that we could cover in, a real short time. I think you've done an excellent job in getting the waterfront covered. But that's part of the issue. I mean, here in Delaware, it's sea level rise. There's lots of other things going on that we could talk about. And I think but the key is, why are we doing all this? Is it real? And I think the case for realism says it's not a disastrous future in every way. So the question then is, why are we doing this? And I think Cal has done an excellent job of outlining it, that this is really an underlying view that we hate people. We really want to see them going back to poverty. And I'm afraid, the totalitarian mindset is really anti-human. And that's the kind of thing that comes out, I think, in her book, but also that I'm starting to see as we look along, that that these people are not just deluded. Some are clearly deluded, but there is an underlying core that's leading this down a bad path, and I think it's intentional.
Yeah. All right, well, if you want to hear more, and I bet you do, the book is called Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. Climate and Energy, The Case for Realism. And again, it's 16 scientists and various people with expertise on this issue, edited by our guest, Dr. Cal Beisner and Dr. David LeGates. And we thank you both so much for your time. The book, by the way, you can get for free for whatever donation to Cornwall Alliance. Go to cornwallalliance.org/donate. That's cornwallalliance.org/donate, and make your most generous gift to them, and they will, and ask for the book, and they'll send it to you. Cal and David, thank you so much. It's just, this has been great, and I appreciate your expertise, both of you. This is Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
As you're listening to this podcast, and again, Sandy Rios, and I want to thank you so much for listening. If you have the means, I wonder if you would consider a leadership gift to saving babies with preborn in a bigger way. It's a tax-deductible donation, and one of $5,000, for instance, would sponsor preborn's entire network for 24 hours. And that usually saves the average of 200 babies. I mean, that's amazing, isn't it, when you think about how that money would be spent. And they do have an incredible track record of saving babies. To donate, all you have to do is go to preborn.com/Sandy. And, of course, that's if that's too much money for you, $28 provides one ultrasound. So whatever you can afford, go to preborn.com/Sandy.
This morning, the Biden administration is pumping the brakes on new vehicle emission standards, giving automakers more time to ramp up their production of electric cars.
Today marks a historic win for public health, for the environment, and for the future of our country.
Changes appear aimed at addressing industry opposition, along with public reluctance to embrace the technology. The new emission standards will be phased in more slowly than originally proposed, but they eventually get close to the same goal set out by the EPA, to have electric cars make up 56% of sales by the year 2032. Last year, they made up less than 8%. In another change from the proposal, the EPA will now include a range of vehicles to reach its emission goals, including plug-in and hybrid vehicles.
We gave the automobile industry more flexibility to achieve those environmental goals.
It's a delicate balancing act for Biden. The road to his reelection goes through Michigan. The United Auto Workers, which has endorsed Biden, called the revised proposal a more feasible emissions rule that protects workers. The EPA emphasized there's absolutely no mandate to adopt electric vehicles. Former President Trump has campaigned against the new rules.
Crooked Joe has ordered a hit job on Michigan manufacturing.
As president, Trump rolled back emission standards imposed by former President Obama.
The White House claims the new emission standards will save Americans billions of dollars in fuel costs and will reduce pollution, saving on health care costs. Andrew Dimbert, ABC News, New York.
Well, I've asked Bruce, my sweetheart, my former FBI agent, former prosecutor husband, to join me this second day of this discussion. Honey, what struck you about that? What part of that? There's so much.
You know, Sandy, I think what we have to emphasize is that you and I are, and these people that we're on today, we are not tone deaf to being watchful over God's creation. But climate change does not equal climate destruction. And I think the people that push this the hardest actually make the case for us. Because if you look at the way they approach this quote-unquote problem, they kind of play whack-a-mole. In other words, you heard Biden in that clip, you know, the standards were going to be set at thus and such because without it, it's the end of the world. But then when they figure out that some of their constituents, being the auto manufacturers, are going to have a problem meeting those standards, gee, all of a sudden the standards change. And now we
it's
make
okay
it
to wait.
Less. It's okay.
Maybe
it's,
we won't
guess,
be destroyed in 13
guess,
years, yeah, not 12.
I guess there's not as big a problem as we thought. And you see that over and over again. Going back to what the gentlemen were saying, just the different labeling of these movements over the years, climate cooling, climate change. I mean, it in just 30, 40 years, we've probably seen it called three or four different things. So if it's really that that imperative that the world is, you know, if we don't change, it's going to be destroyed, I think is just a myth.
Yeah.
And this is a moneymaker for a lot of people. And you have to be rational when you look at this.
Yeah. Thus, this book, The Case for Realism, and we highly recommend it. I want to say one more time, you know, you can get this for free. As Cal mentioned, he's offering it, well, not if for a donation, to cornwallalliance.org. cornwallalliance.org/donate. Just donate whatever you can, whatever amount, and ask for the book. I want to close out. Thank you, honey. I want to close out by going back to that story that I alluded to when I was discussing with them an interview with Barry Weiss, with writer Paul Kingsworth. And again, remember, he was an ecologist. In fact, he was the leading voice in the left-wing environmental magazine of that name, The Ecologist. He changed himself to a bridge in protest of road construction. He was a believer and a leader in this movement. And he is now converted from a practicing Buddhist and Wiccan, that means a witch, to an Orthodox Christian. And I thought it would be really kind of nice to close this show, because it's this day after Easter that we're recording this, with his comments about Easter, and here they are. He said, in the church, the resurrection is the biggest, most astonishing, weirdest thing that's ever happened to humanity. And it is exactly something that happens when all hope is gone, when your Messiah has just been crucified and buried. Then this astonishing, impossible, and unexpected thing happens, which not only brings him back, but also completely rewires your understanding of what the world is and how it works. And that's what my coming to Christianity did to me. At every Easter, or Pascha, as we call it in the Eastern Church, each year the story deepens for me. It's interesting, because I used to think that you became a Christian and that's that, and you're sorted. But it's not that. It's the beginning of a journey, and every year the journey gets deeper. So every time you go through the cycle of 40 days of fasting and then a feast of Easter, something else deepens. It's like you just dropped a couple of inches deeper into this thing that you're in. And as I say, the world changes shape. So that is the kind of steady hope, and it's always there. Doesn't matter what humans do, and not everything is under our control. And that's okay. There's always something else. There's always somebody holding you. That's how it feels, and it's rather wonderful. Doesn't remove the struggles from your life, but it means that they're in a bigger context of you always being held and watched by something much bigger that's happening. So yeah, Easter is a pretty wonderful time. Yes, Easter is a pretty wonderful time. I hope you had a great one, and I want to thank you for listening today. You know you can call us at 662-821-2040. You can write us at sandy@afr.net. You can listen to the podcast at afr.net, or go to sandyrios.com, or go to your favorite podcast platform. You can listen to any of those places. But meanwhile, thank you so much for listening to today's edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.